From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
Hi there, it is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. A couple of hours of news, information, fun, frivolity. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. It is Friday, September 14th, 2007. 2 whole hours today, Luke. We're going to do it.
That's a lot of show. I'm just looking at the rundown. There's all kinds of interesting stuff, though, including a genetic testing company that's marketing a test, the first of its kind, that could actually determine a woman's chances, increased chances anyway, of developing breast or ovarian cancer. We're going to talk to someone who took the test and also find out about some of the sort of ethical questions about the whole production.
And we're ripping a story from the headlines of the New York Times about a campaign to what's being described as standardize what religious materials that prisoners are actually allowed to read.
Plus some legal trouble for New York Knicks GM Isaiah Thomas and what star player Stephon Marbury has to do with the case.
It's so nasty.
Yeah, it really is.
It's
not
just
pleasant
nasty
reading, which is why we decided to bring it to you.
Of course, and why it's on the cover of every New York paper.
Exactly.
We'll also take you on a ramble, check in with the most clicked-on story on the interwebs, and debut a new segment where we try to stump NPR reporter and former Jeopardy contestant Mike Pesca on some potent quotables.
We're going to get today's top stories also from our news maven, Rachel Martin, in just a minute. First, though, here's the BPP's big story.
The way forward I've described tonight makes it possible, for the first time in years, for people who have been on opposite sides of this difficult debate to come together.
That's President Bush from last night. He spoke for about 18 minutes from the Oval Office. The headline was, as expected, even predicted on this very program yesterday,
by Miss Cleo.
That's right. I know everything. Mr. Bush accepted General Petraeus' recommendation that the few thousand troops that are going to be leaving Iraq in the coming months not be replaced, and also that a gradual reduction of forces by at least 21,000 troops happen by next July. That would bring things down to just about pre-surge levels.
Now, the president used the phrase, quote, return on success to describe the criteria for the drawdown. He never used the word withdrawal.
Democrats, of course, were quick to attack the speech. They said it provided little change and few concrete commitments. Rhode Island Senator Jack Reed provided the Democratic response.
Tonight, a nation eager for change in Iraq heard the president speak about his plans for the future. But once again, the president failed to provide either a plan to successfully end the war or a convincing rationale to continue it.
So all of this was pretty much expected. But there was one part of the president's speech that was a bit surprising. It was his this comment on oil revenues.
Iraq's national leaders are getting some things done. For example, they have passed a budget. They're sharing oil revenues with the provinces.
This got our attention here at BPP World Headquarters because just yesterday, literally like 5.5 hours before the president made this speech, the Associated Press ran a big story, and the headline was, quote, officials say Iraqi oil talks deadlocked.
Yeah, apparently a meeting between the Shiite and Sunni Arab representatives and Kurdish negotiators that was supposed to move them closer to a deal, it failed on Wednesday, the day before President Bush's speech. There are still disagreements over how much power to give the Sunni area of the country where there isn't much oil and how oil fields should be managed. So a deal is definitely not yet in place, although negotiations are expected to continue.
In the next hour, we're going to see what the rest of the world thought of Mr. Bush's speech. We'll take a look at the editorial pages of some of the top papers from around the world. Coming up in just a minute, we'll have an Iraqi journalist here in the studio with us. He arrived here from a visit to Iraq just a couple of weeks ago. Right now, though, let's get the rest of the news from BPP newscaster extraordinaire Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hi, everyone. Here's what's going on in your world. Sunni Arabs in Anbar province today mourn the killing of a tribal leader who helped forge a key alliance between Sunnis and the U.S. military. Abdul Sattar Abu Risha died yesterday in a roadside bombing attack near his home in Ramadi. Abu Risha, who met with President Bush less than 2 weeks ago, led the Anbar Salvation Council. That's a group of Sunni Arab tribes that works with U.S. troops to push Sunni Islamist al-Qaeda elements out of much of Anbar province. Yesterday, Abu-Risha's brother was appointed to lead the council. Tribal leaders have said Abu-Risha's death would not dilute the council's efforts to fight al-Qaeda, but it would make members more cautious. Russian President Vladimir Putin today said there are five people who could possibly succeed him and that the new prime minister, Viktor Zubkov, was one of them. Those were Putin's comments after parliament confirmed Zubkov as prime minister earlier today. In a move that shocked political analysts, Putin named Zubkov, a 66-year-old low-profile financial regulator, to the prime ministerial post after firing his entire government. The trial of polygamist Warren Jeffs got underway yesterday in St. George, Utah. 51-year-old Jeffs is the leader of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He's been charged with two counts of rape as an accomplice for using his church authority to coerce a marriage between a 14-year-old girl and her 19-year-old first cousin. Jeffs was a fugitive for nearly 2 years and was on the FBI's most wanted list when he was arrested last year. If convicted, he could spend life in prison. Jeffs is not charged with polygamy, and the marriage between the girl and her cousin was monogamous. Testimony continues today. And the head coach of the New England Patriots, Bill Belichick, won't be suspended for his football espionage, but he will have to pay a $500,000 fine. And the team will also be docked $250,000 and lose a first-day draft pick next year. It was the biggest fine ever for a coach, and the first time in NFL history a first-round draft pick has been confiscated as a penalty. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell found the Patriots guilty of using videotape to try to steal the New York Jets' signals during last Sunday's game. I'm Rachel Martin. The news is always online at npr.org. Allison and Luke, back to you.
Thank you so much, Rachel. As if anyone needs to steal the Jets' signals. But
you live in New York now, buddy. You better be careful.
Nobody knows what I look like.
All right. Last night's presentation to the American people, President Bush said he described the situation on the ground, what it's like in Iraq. He described it from the Oval Office in Washington, D.C. Now, what do you say we ask someone who is from Iraq, has lived there, chose to leave, and is bold enough to attempt to document the goings-on at one Baghdad hospital? Ali Fadil is an Iraqi journalist, documentary filmmaker, and a physician who is now living and studying in the United States, and he's in our studios with us this morning. Ali, thanks for coming down and joining us on the Bryant Park Project.
You're welcome.
Now, you just returned from a three-month stay in Iraq after having been in the U.S. for about a year and a half. How are things there now compared to when you were there last in January of 2006?
Pretty much changed, of course. Iraq is very well known to be changing every day. Mm-hmm. And in fact, things were really bad, worse than what it was in 2006.
When you say things, what kind of things do you mean?
Well, basically the security in the street. I used to work really a little bit more freely in 2006 than now in 2007 when I went back to Iraq. The streets are really blocked by many checkpoints. You can see that. I mean, I was told by people to be careful not to go back from the airport to the hotel after 6 because that's too dangerous. That wasn't the case back in 2006. There are certain neighborhoods that I can't go in because my name, because people think I'm Sunni or I'm Shia, so I have to be careful. There are certain neighborhoods that you should not go in, whether you're Sunni or Shia. So
you have to think about a lot just simply walking down the street at this point.
Definitely a lot. You have to have your instruction manual, which is people telling you this is what's right, this is what's wrong, this neighborhood has changed. There is no entrance from this side, you have to go from the other side. And be careful, Qaeda is on the west and the Shia militia is on the east and so on and so forth, which is going on in every part of Baghdad.
Now, what led you to leave Iraq in January of 06?
I actually, in January of 06, I had I was filming on a documentary about the reconstruction program for Channel 4 in London. And what happened is on January 8, 2006, U.S. forces raided my house. They thought at that time that Jill Carroll, the Christian Science Monitor journalist, was in my house. She was kidnapped the same night.
Yeah. And for people who might have forgotten, Jill Carroll was this reporter whose face was all over the news because she was being held captive and she was recording these tapes. They thought she was in your house?
Exactly. They thought she's in my house. They were looking for her in every drawer of my house, trying to find her. I don't know how they got this. But anyway, they detained me for a night. They destroyed my house. They used explosives on the doors. And
Were you home at the time when they came?
Thank God I was home. They shot bullets in my bedroom where I was sleeping with my wife and my two kids.
Do you have bad feelings about U.S. soldiers as a result of that?
Well, of course. I mean, the thing is, I always, as a journalist, I always hear people talking about how your soldiers humiliated them or entered their houses and their bedrooms while they're sleeping with their wives, and now experiencing it by myself. And then I got, they detained me. They put me in a Bradley. You face, you know, your eyes are blindfolded, and you don't know what's going on around. They bring a dog, barks at you. They take you to a known place, and at the end result, they say, "We're sorry, there was a mistake. We thought we came to the wrong address."
Wow. So at this point in your life, you've made the decision to try to document what's going on. You've had these incredible personal experiences, and specifically about a hospital a lot of people hear about in the news, Yarmouk Hospital. Can you describe for us what neighborhood it's in and how the neighborhood affects the way the work is done in the hospital?
Well, first of all, to know about this hospital, it's the second largest hospital in Iraq after Medical City. And it's, in fact, it's the first trauma center in Iraq and the busiest. It has the busiest emergency room probably in the world. They have, I mean, the normal is 150 patients a day. That's the normal. But sometimes it's even worse, probably in the hundreds. It lies actually in an area called Al Yarmouk District. And that district is a very well known where Sunni extremists, Sunni jihadists, and Al Qaeda are living. But also, the hostel is on the edge of the neighborhood and makes it very clear to other Shiite and mixed neighborhoods like Am al Bayah and jihad districts. And also, it's close to the airport road, which is a very well known dangerous road. The problem is, it makes the hospital really a ground where everyone is fighting for.
It's in the crossroads, it sounds like, of all these different people plying for power. So which group is running the hospital at this point?
It's very hard to tell, but from the inside, it's the Mehdi army, definitely, the Sadr people. They're running the hospital from the inside. From the outside and the exterior, it's the Sunni extremists holding the streets around. And I mean, for example, when they arrived at the hospital and the doctor saying, "How could you enter the hospital?" I'm like, "Why? What's wrong?" And they said, "Well, actually, just this morning, just a few hours ago, a sniper just shot a paramedic in the backyard of the hospital. And this is what's going on from outside. Inside the hospital, another day I arrive, and I find a big problem happening where one of the Mehdi army hit a doctor, an orthopedic surgeon, who's the most senior doctor in the hospital. He hit him with a cooking pan on his head, knocking him down on the ground. And the end result, the doctors tried to defend their colleague, and the Mehdi army said, "We will investigate your intentions. You doctors, you have bad intentions about us." The end result, the doctors could not leave the hospital for 2 weeks because of the Mehdi army threats.
And the Mehdi army, we should just point out too, is Muqtada al-Sadr, who's this very powerful Shia leader.
Yeah.
And this is kind of his soldiers, his force, and they're running this hospital right now.
Now, they're not supposed to be running this hospital. Who's supposed to be running this hospital?
Well, in fact, the opposite. They are supposed to run this hospital because the Ministry of Health, which controls all of the hospitals of Iraq, government hospitals of Iraq, it's, in fact, the minister, the former minister, and it's still is a Shiite from the Mehdi, from the Sadr bloc, and the end result, all of the Ministry of Health itself is, in fact, part of their organization rather than the government. And this is the case of every other ministry in the government.
So what happened to Paul Bremer's group?
What do you mean, Paul Bremer?
Paul Bremer's group that was supposed to set up sort of protecting this hospital and making sure this hospital was able to do business.
Well, that's back in 2003 and 2004.
That's history, as far as I know.
That's history, exactly. Okay. In fact, it laid the ground for them. And the problem is with the elections, and that's the problem no one wants to admit, that the election itself brought these other people, brought some part of the insurgency and some part of the militias into the government. But in fact, it brought them with their arms, not without their arms. They're not politicians. They are warlords inside this government. They're, in fact, controlling it by one way or another. And the end result, as you see, all of the hospitals in Iraq, except hospitals in Sunni areas, are controlled by the Mahdi militias. In Yarmouk Hospital, they sit there, wait for their victims, the injured people, injured Sunni, for example, from a firefight between the Mahdi army and the Sunni insurgents in the mixed areas. They wait for them. When they, as soon as they arrive, they take them out from the hospital, investigate them. Nobody knows where they go. They ended up as, you know, dumped corpse in the street.
One of the reasons we wanted to speak to you today, obviously, was because of President Bush's speech last night. I want to play you a short clip and then get you to respond.
1 year ago, much of Baghdad was under siege. Today, most of Baghdad's neighborhoods are being patrolled by coalition and Iraqi forces who live among the people they protect. Many schools and markets are reopening, and ordinary life is beginning to return. These gains are a tribute to our military. They are a tribute to the courage of the Iraqi security forces, and they are the tribute to an Iraqi government that has decided to take on the extremists.
What do you make of what the President of the United States said?
Let me start from the end. Iraqi government that people belong to. In fact, Iraqis in Iraq, they feel there is no government, and this government is not a real government. It's just a bunch of politicians talking about what's happening inside the green zone. And if he's talking about, if the president is talking about neighborhoods that now open, I think he should go and visit Amal, Bayah, Jihad, Khadra, Ghazali, Adil, Mansour, and I can keep on giving him names, mm-hmm. and names. Let me go to one neighborhood, Amal neighborhood, which is used to be one of the liveliest neighborhoods in Baghdad. Now it's hell. It's in fact fractioned in two parts. One is called the Janabis part, which is a Sunni tribal group, and one is the Mahdi army part. And in the middle, there's the killing and the dead bodies. You'd find it every day. As soon as I arrived there, my friend, Dr. Omar, who's also a doctor, who's also a filmmaker, his father got killed in that neighborhood. He was visiting his daughter, and he just went outside the house, and a car came by, passed by, and took him, put him in the car. Then they dumped his body in the street. I myself went to find, to collect his body, because his son's name is Omar, and Omar is a Sunni name. He can't go to the morgue, Baghdad morgue, because it's controlled by the Mahdi army again, and they have a checkpoint outside the morgue, and in fact they're inside the morgue. They prevent anyone from anyone, any Sunni, if he arrives, they will just kill him and throw him in the morgue. What happened is I went inside, and I talked to the people inside the morgue, and even to the security police outside, and they say, well, we call the dead bodies coming every day to the morgue the miswag, which is an Iraqi word for shopping cart.
Hmm.
They say, we have the shopping cart that comes from Amal neighborhood, or the shopping cart that comes from Jihad, the shopping cart that comes from Sadr City. So these dead bodies, and they said it arrives every day, and they don't know the time for every car, and they're from everywhere.
Yeah.
The problem is, and this is for the president and what he thinks, that the neighborhoods are really safe. In fact, it's not safe. Everything that was going in 2006 is still going on, probably less than 2006. And people in Iraq say it's a success. I ask the Iraqis how it's a success. It's a hell. They say this hell you see in front of you is nothing compared to the hell in 2006. And I'm like, God, what happened in 2006?
And here's the bigger part of that story. You're one person and you have this story. Think about all the people who live in a country the size of California who have stories like this. Ali Fadil, Iraqi journalist, documentary filmmaker, and physician. Thank you so much for sharing so much personal information and your thoughts with us. Good luck with your documentary about Yarmouk Hospital.
Thank you. Coming up on the show, a company is marketing. Coming up on the Ryan Park Project, we're going to talk about a genetic test for breast cancer and ovarian cancer. It's the first of its kind, but it's also raising some serious concerns. And also, we'll take a ramble down to college, along with a curvaceous new... I should really look at these teases before I actually try to read them, don't you think?
That would be okay by me.
We're going to take a ramble to college along with curvaceous new co-ed, Shakira. Every freshman boy's dream lab partner. Shakira is going to college, not to spoil it for people, but we'll talk about that coming up.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Welcome
You are listening to The Bryant Park Project from NPR News, always online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Luke Burbank. Wondering if counting out loud to a million has negative effects on a person's mental health. We're going to get to that in a minute. Right now, though, it's time for the ramble.
A college course you can really wrap your head around. YouTube 101. It's happening out in California. They're planning on offering something called Learning from YouTube. It's Pitzer College, by the way, for all you high school seniors out there listening. Media studies, of course. And if you can't make it to class, all lectures taped, posted on YouTube.
Of course. Also in YouTube news, the artist currently known as Prince, he's trying to sue YouTube for hosting unauthorized clips of him. He says he's trying to reclaim his art. Prince is mad that YouTube can filter pornography, but can't or won't filter unauthorized clips of him. He's also suing eBay for the same reason.
Prince, time on his hands, basically.
Apparently.
Okay, this is your big story. These hips don't lie, Luke.
I know they don't, Allison.
But they go to class, apparently. Shakira is going to be taking classes studying history of Western civilization at UCLA. Okay, that was a gut at my college, history of Western civilization. She considered herself a history buff. The professor said he was impressed with her intelligence and was astonished to learn she was a pop star.
All right.
Because he never goes out.
I'm actually trying to, as we talk on this show, this is radio in action. Oh, he's counting. This is awesome. I just checked in with a buddy of ours in Alabama. He's not a buddy yet, but okay. I'm hoping we will interview him. He's just a friend we haven't met yet. He's an Alabama guy. He's trying to count to a million out loud, and he is filming himself on the internet. The site is called milliontcount.com. The guy is named Jeremy Harper. Let's just listen in for a second here. 995,516, 995,517, 995,518, 995,519. All right, that's enough. Seriously, that's enough.
Okay, there's going to be a remix somewhere.
It's kind of musical. You're right.
This guy named 995,001.
This guy's name is Jeremy Harper. He started 89 days ago. He's been raising money for charity. He's got $10,000 so far. It started out apparently as just a conversation with him and his friends. What if you tried to count to a million? And he's doing it. He's supposed to end today. And for 89 days, he's just been counting. I think it's going about 15,000 places per day.
Can we just keep checking back with him?
Yeah, definitely.
All right. That's what I would really like. All right, so that's it for the ramble for this Friday, February 14th. And now to a story that we wish we thought of first, ripped off from the headlines. The New York Times reported this week on the Bureau of Prisons removing collections of religious books and materials from many faiths from the federal prisons. The purge was done under something called the Standardized Chapel Library Project, and it comes from a 2004 report by the Justice Department recommending steps prisons should take to combat, quote, the growth of militant religious groups. Chaplain Paul Rogers is the current chaplain at Dodge Correctional Institute in Waupun, Wisconsin. He also contributed to a report published last year on combating extremism in prisons. Chaplain, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Allison.
So this whole scenario came to light when two prisoners, one an Orthodox Jew, another a Protestant Christian, in an upstate New York prison, they filed this lawsuit saying their religious rights had been violated by this new law. What was your first reaction when you heard about the purging of these religious materials from federal prisons?
Well, this wasn't the first I heard of it. I think this is when a couple inmates were able to get some other people to notice. I knew there was a council of rabbis that wrote a letter to the BOP director, Harry Lapham. They were talking about this for quite a few months, about getting rid of these religious books in the prison chapels. And I was just astonished by that.
Why were you astonished? Explain that a little further.
Well, one of the reasons they gave, at least that was reported, was that they were concerned about, of course, anything that would have to do with terrorism, radicalizing inmates, things that might have been hateful what's bothersome is prisons across the country have already rules regarding what type of publications can be sent in. And I agree with the rabbis that it seems to be like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. If there's a couple books that are troublesome, they can simply be removed under the current rules. Now, how they're trying to administer it is not only do that, but limit the number of books for each religious group. Now, I never heard that there was a problem with space. That maybe could be true, but that didn't seem to surface. That you know, that the chapels or they didn't have the ability to administer some of these books. Get them. It's all about access. You know that.
Well, one of the things about this report, though, it was done in the name of terrorism. The idea that you should remove these books so that people don't become radicalized in prison. Do you think this is cover for simply wanting to remove Islamist texts and writings?
Well, they're not only doing that, they're removing Christian books, Buddhist books, Jewish books. It really doesn't have
But are
have
they
any...
after the Islamic texts? That's what some people believe.
Well, that's going to be covered also, but not only the problem is there's already rules to get rid of publications that are not allowed for security reasons. So they've kind of, this is a little bit of a covert attempt to
but they can't just say we can't have the Quran in here, but we can have Bibles. And so
They can have Qurans, they can have Bibles, and but these are other like study texts. And even there, the Muslims would be able to have, they said 150 books.
Now, in your opinion, though, are there some texts which have a religious basis which may not be appropriate for prisoners
sure.
to have access to? You do think that?
Right. Yeah, I'm not hardly a great fan of censoring books. I believe that inmates need to read and just read about anything, but for security purposes, obviously we don't want people learning how to make bombs, learning how to escape. We want to encourage them how to improve their lives, and part of that would be developing their spiritual life, their moral life, so that when they get out and rejoin the community, that they can be productive citizens. So they do have people, and hopefully you have professional chaplains there that can help with the vetting process of when there's a book in question.
One of the things that's been sort of interesting is the list of books that they've talked about removing, and it's also multimedia resources, has been quite kept very, very quiet. Do you have any information?
Yeah, because there's a First Amendment right here. Now, like I said, there's I think how the Bureau of Prisons is administering it is a little bit of a cover because there was never a problem before. Was there a problem with too many books? Okay, because now how the policy, I guess, is written that each group can have up to 150 books or publications. Well, some may have less than that. Some may have more. You're talking about many of these books were donated by religious communities from the community to be used for the benefit of the inmates.
Chaplain, do you think it's a good or bad policy?
It's a bad policy. And I would, maybe one little suggestion is, since I don't want to ban things, the big concern is they're just getting rid of good books.
Right.
Now, maybe the chapel shouldn't have chapel libraries. Maybe most prisons have a regular library.
And they should maybe be included there.
And they should have maybe a whole section on religious texts and things.
That's
and
one
they could
excellent
administer
suggestion.
It, and the inmates would be able to have access, and they would not be able to lose many of these precious books that guys are using.
Chaplain Paul Rogers, thank you so much for weighing in on this story. We appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. What would you do if you were a 30 or 40-something woman and you saw this commercial come on TV?
Breast cancer runs in my family.
My mother.
My grandmother.
My dad's sisters.
I wondered if it would be inevitable.
I found out it didn't have to be. I found out my risk through BRAC analysis.
This is an ad for something called BRAC analysis. It's the first genetic test that could tell a woman if she has a higher risk of breast or ovarian cancer. The spots are showing during Oprah and Dr. Phil. Here's the catch, though. It's only a very, very, very small percentage of women who actually have this gene mutation. And it doesn't even really guarantee that they will get cancer. It just means the chances are greater that they could develop cancer. Some ethicists say that they're a little bit leery about this test because it can cost up to $3,000. Also, they're wondering about the ad campaign. We're going to talk to an ethicist in a minute. First, though, a woman who had the test and has had to make some incredibly hard decisions after getting the results, Connie Elliott of Salt Lake City, is with us now. Hi, Connie.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for coming on and talking about this with us. It's obviously a really personal event in your life. What prompted you in the first place to have this BRAC analysis test?
Well, about 2 years ago, my sister was diagnosed with fallopian tube cancer, which is, I guess, a very rare form, falls under the ovarian cancer. And she went through her first set of chemo treatments, and then she went in for the testing. She wanted to know, you know, where was this coming from? And so she had the extensive test done and was tested with the BRCA2 mutation.
And so then that prompted you to go ahead and get this test done as well?
Yes, yeah. With the information that she gave us, you know, from the clinics and her doctors and the genetic counselors, they have a packet and they sent it out to all of her siblings and then, you know, their children. And based on that information and the risk factors that, you know, I would be facing if I indeed had the same mutation, you know, that prompted me to be tested because I definitely did not want to go through what she's going through.
And you got the test done, and it turns out you also have this genetic mutation.
I do.
Where were you when you got the result, and what went through your mind?
It's actually sitting in my office. With my husband, and when the counselor called, and I opted to have the results given to me over the phone. You can go into the office or you can have it over the phone.
So you were at work.
I was at work, yeah. And at first I was kind of going into it as I really felt, you know, I'm not going to have the mutation, I'm going to be fine. And then when they tell you, it's kind of a shock factor because reality really sets in.
What went through your mind when you heard the news?
Just kind of a sinky feeling, you know, thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, I do not want to face the fate that my sister has.
Yeah.
But first it's shock, and then it's like, well, you know what? I can fix this.
Well, that's kind of why we wanted to talk to you as well, because you took some very proactive steps. What did you do in the aftermath of getting this result?
Well, the first step that I took was to have a total hysterectomy, and that was done within a couple of months of finding out. And a lot of that, I mean, it's different for each woman. A lot of it is, you know, based on my personal decisions on children, where I was at, and my age. And so I had chosen, and even by the encouragement of my sister who's going through this, she's like, have it done sooner than later because, you know, she had gone through all of her yearly routines and everything. And within 3 months of having that, she was diagnosed with stage 4.
Wow.
So it's so hard to detect that's one of the things they say, you know, let's go in and just take care of this and reduce your risk.
And I understand that you're also scheduled to have a double mastectomy?
Yes.
So your entire, you know, body has been radically changed by this information that you have this genetic mutation. Do you ever wonder if you're overreacting?
No, I mean, I take a stance that, you know, if I can protect myself or if I can make something better with the information and things that I have at my disposal, I'm going to do it. I'm going to take advantage of what's there for me. And it's totally a personal decision. I'm not one that's attached to any particular part of my body. And I did the research and I saw the reconstruction that can be done and, you know, have spoken to the doctors and you know, my decision. I felt comfortable that when I'm done with this, I'll be fine.
Well, let's bring somebody else into the conversation now, Connie. We've got Dr. Arthur Kaplan on the line. He's chair of the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Hi, Dr. Kaplan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Well, obviously, this test gave this woman, Connie Elliott, some really useful information, but she's in a very small minority of women who actually would potentially have this. Does that give you reason for concern about the kind of wide approach they're taking with advertising this genetic test?
It does. Connie's case is one in which she's got a hereditary form of cancer, ovarian showed up, could be breast. That accounts for about 10% of breast cancer. Maybe one in 400 women will have the mutation that she and her sister had. If you smoke or have a high-fat diet or exposed to certain chemicals, that's the overwhelming majority of breast cancer cases not associated with this mutation. So the company is advertising broadly to all women. Their rationale is, well, we'll still pick up some women like Connie who don't know they have this in their family. But I worry about that because I think a lot of women are going to be frightened who don't have this family history of immediate genetic relatives with ovarian or fallopian or breast cancer. They don't need to come in and get this test. It doesn't make sense to spend the $3,000 that way.
Well, I mean, though, let's just say that it's covered by insurance or somebody has the resources. I mean, if 100 women find out that they have this, isn't that worth something?
It is worth something, although I think you'd spend the money in a better way if you kept going after high-fat diet reduction, lifestyle change, more breast cancer exams, even stopping smoking campaigns, because those are the bulk of the causes, not the genes.
You think it's sort of needle in a haystack insurance?
There is a little bit of needle in the haystack going on. I worry that, you know, people are going to focus in on the BRCA1 and 2 forms of cancer, and they're important. I don't mean to say not important, but the overwhelming number of women who get breast cancer are not going to get it for these reasons. They're going to get it later in life for lifestyle choices or other genes that we can't figure out yet. So it is a kind of applying a gigantic shotgun when a rifle would make more sense in terms of advertising. What you want to do is say, if you've got immediate relatives who've had breast or ovarian cancer, think about this test.
Dr. Kaplan, as the sort of we continue to map the genome, though, I mean, we're going to have more and more of these kinds of tests for different kinds of things. Is that going to be a good thing?
I think it's going to be a good thing. I'm all for more genetic knowledge, but it has a downside. If you go in for this test, some companies are going to say, you know what, for your life insurance or health insurance, if you're getting tested for a particular costly, risky disease, maybe we don't want to insure you. I know of companies that have said just getting the test, not even with a positive result, that's enough to scare them into saying we're not going to write life insurance. So we don't have right now good protection of genetic privacy. And technically, when you find a genetic disease, whether it's this one or other ones coming down the road, tests for diabetes or depression, whatever, those are pre-existing conditions. And as I think many listeners know, those will void your health or life insurance policies if you know you've got them and you don't disclose them. So we got a lot of infrastructure, ethical and legal, to build if we're going to take advantage of the genetic revolution.
I mean, Dr. Kaplan, would you tell women in your family to get this test if, say, the money wasn't an object?
I'd say get the test if there's a family history. I'd say get it by paying out of pocket. I'd say don't try to charge your insurance company because that may be the end of your insurance.
Connie Elliott of Salt Lake City, you got to probably feel like this test saved your life.
Yeah, I do in a sense that, you know, my risk was increased by so much, and I wasn't willing to gamble by, you know, I mean, there's a risk, you know, a chance that I could not, you know, I wouldn't get cancer. I don't have cancer right now, but I'm not willing to take that risk of down the line finding out that I could have taken care of it now and then faced reality, you know, by having to fight cancer in the future.
Well, Connie Elliott of Salt Lake City, the Prudential Real Estate Branch, if my internet snooping is up to snuff, thank you for coming on the show. And Dr. Arthur Kaplan from the University of Pennsylvania, thank you so much, both of you, for taking the time.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having this great program.
Let's see, Allison. Hopefully you have, as you typed away over there, found the next list of awesome things we're going to be talking about
in
this show.
Absolutely. You know, what did I come in Monday and say I went to see at the movies?
I saw Superbad again.
You're obsessed.
No, I'm not obsessed. There just weren't that many good movies out last weekend. But apparently that's going to change very soon, according to NPR's movie critic Bob Mondello, who will join us with the first of the fall fair of the movie season, getting close to Oscar nomination time. So there's some good films out there.
We've also got what I think is a very promising new segment where we try to stump NPR's resident know-it-all, one Michael Pesca.
He stood up when you said that.
I know.
He's standing in the hall and he literally said, me? Who, me?
Yeah, like he just happened to be, you know, loitering outside the studio for no reason.
Is counting guy, the guy's counting to a million, going? Let's see. Let's check in on him. Where is he? Trying to get to a million by today?
Back up and ready. 995,845.
He's on a roll.
That's Jeremy Harper from Alabama, who is counting to a million. He's supposed to finish today. Go to milliontcount.com. Go to milliontcount.com and check it out and see if he's still counting.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Hey, everybody, I'm Allison Stewart, and welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. You can always find us online at npr.org/Bryant Park.
And just a kind of quick, you know, postscript on the interview we just did talking about this genetic test for being predisposed to having breast or ovarian cancer. We do have a statement, actually, from the company Myriad Genetics that actually does this test. We're going to post that on our website, making sure they get their say in all of this. Also coming up, we are going to stump one of the greatest minds of our generation. Who writes this crap? Mike Pesca.
You know what? It's our new editor, Tricia McKinney. Who
I mean,
is,
this awesome stuff.
She's got a little bit of an intellectual crush on Mike Pesca. I'm outing her right now.
Whoa.
She's such a huge NPR fan before she started working here that when she met Mike Pesca, she got all gooey. So I'm just putting that straight up.
Awkward.
Trisha's married to Vern and Cassie, and she's got a lovely life. But I said intellectual crush.
Wow. Okay, let's just do something that involves us not talking about this anymore. How about a news update from Rachel Martin?
This is NPR.
Hi, everyone. Here's your news update. The White House told Congress today that Iraqi leaders are making little progress toward meeting key military and political goals. The report comes just a day after President Bush said that progress in Iraq justifies a large continued U.S. military presence there. The administration's first report on benchmarks last July showed the Iraqi government was making okay progress toward meeting only 8 of 18 goals. The follow-up report to Congress today concluded that Iraqis have made progress on only one benchmark, allowing former members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party to hold government positions. But yesterday, President Bush said the situation in Iraq is improving and a strong U.S. presence is needed for at least 10 more months. Bush did announce a partial and gradual troop drawdown of 130,000 troops by next summer, but it didn't satisfy Democrats. In a broadcast response to Bush's speech, Democratic Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, a West Point graduate, said Bush has failed to successfully end the war, he's failed to give a good reason for keeping it going.
Do we continue to heed the president's call that all Iraq needs is more time, more money, and the indefinite presence of 130,000 American troops, the same number as 9 months ago? Or do we follow what is in our nation's best interest and redefine our mission in Iraq?
The speech sets the stage for a legislative clash expected next week in the Senate as Democrats try to push legislation that would force a change in Iraq policy. Leading Democrats say it's unlikely they'll find the votes to set a timetable for withdrawal, and instead they'll focus on legislation that puts a ceiling on the number of troops deployed and mandatory rest time between deployments. And while sectarian violence plagues much of Iraq, residents in the northern part of the country are fighting another battle, this one against cholera. The World Health Organization today announced that cholera has broken out in northern Iraq. The diarrheal disease has made 16,000 people sick, and it's killed at least 10 people. The WHO warned that the outbreak could spread further unless people have access to clean water, safe food, and better sanitation. And former Prime Minister of Pakistan Benazir Bhutto will return to Pakistan next month after spending the past 8 years in exile. Bhutto's political party made the announcement today. Bhutto is in talks with President General Pervez Musharraf that could lead to a power-sharing deal after Pakistan's general election scheduled for the end of this year. A government spokesman said Bhutto would not be deported the way another former prime minister was earlier this week, but the government said she will have to face corruption charges when she returns. And Google is having moon dreams these days. The internet search giant is doing what it can to encourage lunar exploration by sponsoring what it's calling the Google Lunar X Prize. The company will pay out tens of millions of dollars in prizes for landing unmanned rovers on the moon. The international competition challenges entrants to land a robotic vehicle on the moon, make it travel at least 500 meters, and beam video images and other data back to Earth. The first company to win the private sector pace race by 2012 would take home a cool $20 million. I'm Rachel Martin. The news is always online at npr.org. Luke and Allison, back to you.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Hey, everybody. Remember this?
I am not gay. I never have been gay.
Idaho Senator Larry Craig denying that his wide stance in a men's airport bathroom means he likes to have sex with men. Well, our next guest, also a Republican like the senator, and like Mr. Craig, said he was not gay until about a week ago. Joel Marino is a senior studying journalism at Florida International University and a reporter for the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel. He came out this week in his college's newspaper prompted by the Craig scandal. Joel joins us now by phone. Hey, how are you?
Hey, good morning, guys. How's it going?
Going forward. So what was it about the Larry Craig incident that made you realize that you wanted to come out?
Well, it was something that I'd been thinking about for a while, and then I was following this case. I remember being at work one morning, typing away at a story, and Craig was actually doing a press conference that you guys just played. And I just stopped, and I turned around, and I looked at that TV, and I looked at Craig's face, and I just saw him so adamantly saying, you know, I'm not gay. And I stopped, and I just then, I guess, looked at myself. Am I going to be like that someday, you know, 62, still denying this, living a double life? And as soon as that happens, I guess something inside of me snapped. I called a friend of mine, and you know, I let him know, and from then it just kept going.
Let me back up and get a little information about how you were living your life when you were a younger man. Did you think, okay, I'm gay and I hope nobody finds out? Or did you have the stance of, hey, there's no way I'm gay, I'm not really going to engage in these feelings?
Actually, it was a mix of both. It's the way I see it, it's more of a progression, you know, like the 12 steps. You begin with denial, then you move on to the next step. And for a long time, I guess, in my high school years, I went with the second one, where I just thought, this can't be it. This is something that happens to other people, but not me. And I actually was involved in a couple of process in high school to ban Gay Straight Alliance Club from forming in our high school. That's how, you know, adamantly I was that I wasn't gay.
Did you ever use slurs, gay slurs, in conversation if someone engaged in it?
When I was younger, I'd say maybe early high school. But after that, I decided not to use it anymore. It's once in a while with friends we toss it around, but I never really said it to anybody meaningfully.
Did you ever think that you were actually fooling anyone? I have a friend who came out to me after a long time, and I knew he was gay for a really long time, and I just waited till he told me.
For a long time I used to think, oh, everybody knows, they're just not telling me, or they're being good friends. But the surprise has been that almost everybody who's found out by reading this column has just been shocked. And I know friends who are still saying, no, I mean, I accept it, but inside, I still can't. It must be, a game, a lie, and some people are having trouble accepting it.
Joel, do you think that the experience that you've had with this is going to be something that might be reproduced around the country? Or do you think for somebody who might be gay but also Republican and not out – and by the way, we should also say that nobody knows what Larry Craig is.
Right.
We're not trying to presume that he's gay. I mean, in fact, nothing is substantiated really as to his personal life. But having said that, do you think that this would drive folks who are sort of gay and not out Republicans to be more secretive about it, or to take the road you took, which is to sort of be more public about your sexuality?
Well, I hope people would take the more open route. That's the way I took, and it's a hard route. It's a really hard decision to make, and I really can't say what other people are going through right now, but I just know that myself, it comes to a point where you're just tired of living a secret, because that's what it is. You know, and I'm a reporter, and reporters don't do well with secrets, so I just had to tell somebody. And I just decided to do it the best way I knew as a reporter. I wrote a column about it, and I didn't tell somebody. I told everybody.
Now, you are a Republican, and you know your party's positions on many gay issues, against gay marriage, gays in the military. Do you think, now that you've come out, that you'll remain loyal to the Republican Party?
I don't know. I guess I would consider myself a lapsed Republican. I've been having some trouble with the Republican Party. I consider myself a conservative, if anything. In high school, in civics class, when we studied conservative values, I thought that was something that really appealed to me. And it just doesn't seem to me that the current Republican administration follows these conservative values. They're conservative by name only.
If you had the opportunity to speak privately with Larry Craig and nobody would hear the conversation, what would you say to him?
Well, again, as a reporter, I would definitely just jump in and say, come on, you got to tell me, are you or are you not? But as somebody who's going through the same thing...
We think the same thing. We shouldn't...
Yeah, pretty much. It's, I'd share my story, and if he wants to say anything else, it's up to him, and that's the only way you have to do it. Share your story and see how people react to that.
Joel Marino is a senior at Florida International University. He also reports for the Fort Lauderdale Sun-Sentinel. This week, he came out in his college's newspaper. Joel, really, thank you so much for sharing so much with us. We really appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me.
Yeah, of the many sort of various fallouts from the Larry Craig scandal, that was not the one I would have expected to have happened.
Kind of an interesting one, though, if you think about it, that this person was moved that much.
Yeah.
You know, we've all been sort of watching it from the political angles and what's it going to do next versus somebody having a really personal reaction to the Larry Craig incident.
Well, let's get MJ on El Microfono for a minute. Producer MJ Davis. MJ, you got an email from a friend this week about all these commonly misquoted lines, right? And it kind of blew your mind.
Yeah, it really took me for a loop. I was surprised by how many of them I commonly misquoted. Might know one of them, Luke. It's this quote from this guy, Darth Vader. Hmm. He's this really nasty dude, and he says something to the protagonist like what? Do you know it?
Well, this rings a bell. I think being that people say this to me like over 30 times a day, Darth Vader looks at Luke Skywalker and he says, Luke, I am your father, right?
Do you want to hear what he actually says?
Yeah.
Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him.
No, I am your father.
Oh, see. not Luke, I'm your father. It's I am your father.
Very sneaky, yes.
But suddenly it's not a mystery why Mark Hamill's career didn't really go anywhere after Star
Wars.
Anyway, I digress. Okay, so MJ, then you got kind of obsessed, right? And you started going on Wikipedia and trying to figure out all of these commonly misquoted lines. And as you're wont to do, you started chatting with Mike Pesca, who sits across from you in the office. And you started quizzing him, right?
Yeah, and it was super weird because he knew all of them. And he jumped the gun on some of them. I would say, you know, Mike, what's this quote? Have you heard about this one? He would say, well, that one is actually like this. And there was...
And that's how he talks, too.
Right, exactly. And there was a super weird moment when he gave me a German translation issue on a Voltaire quote out of thin air.
Jeez Louise. Okay, well...
excuse me?
let's you know, we thought we would run with this a little bit. So we decided to create a little game that we think is going to be very popular. We're calling Stump Pesca. I thought we had music there. See, it says cue theme music. Yeah, oh, that's good. Mike Pesca's a full-service game show. He gets stumped. He does the music. It's wonderful. Okay.
Give him a stump.
Oh, yeah. And you turn on your own mic.
Smack him in the rump. Stump Pesca.
He just wrote his own theme song.
That is I officially declare this in front of God and Larry Craig and the listeners of this show that is the new theme song. All right, let's start you off with an easy one, Michael. Let's kind of get you warmed up.
Okay.
Here is your first commonly quoted line. Play it again, Sam. Oh, that's bad. That's a bad impression. That's from Casablanca.
It is?
What is the...
Is it?
Yes.
I don't think it is.
What's the actual quote? What's the actual quote?
Yeah. You know, I think Bogey says to the piano player something like, I thought I told you never to play that song, Sam.
He says that at one point in the film, yeah. I think, but he doesn't. He says something that's a little bit more succinct. Well, let's hear it. The actual clip from Play It Again, Sam, of Play It Again, Sam from Casablanca.
Play it, Sam. Play as time goes by.
Wait, that's not even Humphrey Bogart.
Right.
Humphrey Bogart doesn't even say it.
So when people do the quote, they think it's Humphrey Bogart.
Like I just
right,
did.
Right, right. So I guess we have neither a character saying it. The character is not, you know, Ingrid Bergman comes close to not saying it. So yeah. By the way, in Star Wars, a lot of people think Chewbacca says, but he really says, which in Wookiee, because it's a tonal language. Anyway,
sure.
Go on.
Yeah, thank you. We're going to get into that later on the show. All right, here's another one. This is a common quote. Bubble, bubble, toil and trouble. That's from Macbeth.
Right.
What's the actual quote?
It's let's see. Bubble, bubble, toil and trouble. Cauldron burn. Cauldron and Fill it of a fenny snake in a bubble in a cauldron boil and bake. I have new toe of frog, wing of bat, tongue of dog. But how's it start? It's not bubble, bubble. Toil and trouble?
It's commonly known as bubble, bubble, toil and trouble.
All right, you tell me.
It's actually double, double,
toil
and trouble, fire, burn and cauldron, bubble.
And then we get to the fenny snake part.
Right.
Which you can't find anymore, a decent fenny snake.
I always make it with too much garlic here in New York, I think. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're 0 for 2, actually.
I don't think I'm 0 for 2.
Well, you got Star Wars right, so you're 1 for 3.
All right, sure.
All right, you're still not...
Wait, I got another one. Who said this? 847,943. Sorry, go ahead.
Was that Harper kid?
That Harper kid.
All right. Here's another commonly misquoted line, also from Shakespeare. Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him well.
No, he's talking to his friend Horatio, right? Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him, Horatio.
Mike Pesca, ladies and gentlemen, where's my bell?
All right.
That's absolutely correct. He says, alas, poor Yorick, I knew him well, Horatio, a fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy.
Well, so I'm going to bust that one out on somebody. You are of most excellent fancy.
Talk about how great is Shakespeare. That line has about four things that have become common titles. Infinite Jest, David Foster Wallace book.
Yeah, totally. Okay. Here's one from Winston Churchill. This is commonly misquoted. Blood, sweat, and tears.
Oh, well, that's the name of the band, right? But what about toil? I guess it doesn't fit. What? Goes up.
Easy Three Dog Night.
No.
That's blood, sweat, and tears?
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
All right. So Winston Churchill.
All we have to give is blood, sweat, toil, and tears, right?
That's almost a paraphrase rather than a misquote there because it says, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. So.
Right. That's the correct one. You're right, Michael. Let's give me another
toil in there.
I have nothing to offer by blood, but blood. I think they meant they typed it in here wrong. I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. That's what Winston Churchill actually said. Okay, let's get on to the last one here.
commonly misquoted. Do this one, Allison.
Well, I'm very excited because I watched this last night. It's the last thing I saw on TV before I went to bed.
Okay.
Here's the misquote. Do you feel lucky, punk? I'm squinting my eyes when I say that. The source, Dirty Harry, Clint Eastwood as Harry Callahan.
He says, what you got? He says,
the guy goes at the end, I got to know, which is like the most racist, horrible line in a movie.
Yes, great moments in black cinema, exactly. Let's see, Harry's saying you got to ask yourself. You got to ask yourself, do you feel lucky? Well, do you, punk? Is that it?
Let's take a listen.
Being this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Oh,
do I feel lucky? We literally were watching this on the big 50-inch TV last night.
So why did I get the pronoun wrong?
Yeah.
Does that not count?
Oh, it doesn't count. No ding. I'm going to give you a muffled ding.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a half point.
Mike Tuskett, why do you know all this?
I can't not know it. I want not to know it. I ask not to know it. I say, you know, fill in things like my wife's birthday. Never forget that. No, no.
Oh, Michael. Michael Pesca of now NPR's National Desk. Which means you're going to be hearing a lot of Mike Pesca on a little show called Morning Edition.
Yeah, sort of. I don't want to know it. I can't not hear it.
Yeah.
But I hear him.
That's the first inaugural run of Stump Pesca, and I think it went brilliantly. Thank you, Michael.
Happy to be here.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News for now.